This is JAMDA On The Go, your review of the content featured in JAMDA, the research-focused monthly journal of AMDA, the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast.
Welcome to JAMDA On The Go. This podcast will spotlight articles from the February 2020 issue of JAMDA, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, through the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. We will be speaking with the JAMDA co-editor-in-chief, Dr. Philip Sloan, and associate editor, Dr. Mallory Brown. Dr. Sloan is a family physician and geriatrician with a master's degree in public health. He is the Elizabeth and Oscar Goodwin Distinguished Professor of Family Medicine and Geriatrics at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and co-director for the Program on Aging, Disability, and Long-Term Care at the Cecil G. Shepps Center for Health Services Research. Dr. Brown is also a family physician and geriatrician at the University of North Carolina, where she is Associate Professor of Family Medicine and the Director of the Residency Training Program, as well as an Associate Editor at JAMDA. Dr. Sloan, Dr. Brown, welcome back to JAMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we're happy to be here.
So I understand that we're going to be discussing three topics from the February 2020 issue of JAMDA. Namely around 30-year trends in the United States nursing homes, pain assessment in the nursing home, and the relationship between long-term benzodiazepine use and cognitive decline. Fascinating stuff. Plenty to talk about. So our first topic is about changes in nursing homes between 1985 and 2015, what they have meant for nursing home medicine and what they may mean for the future. Dr. Sloan, what can you tell me about this February 2020 JAMDA paper and topic?
You know, Wayne, sometimes I hate to admit it, but I've been involved in long-term care medicine for a long time. I first became medical director of a nursing home in 1980.
Wow.
So I have a personal perspective on this topic. The article got me wondering what really has changed and what is the same.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this too, and my career in the skilled setting is about half of yours, but I have seen some major changes. You know, the one that immediately came to mind was the Jimmo ruling in 2013, as is the great reduction in the amount of restraint use. But this paper reflects the mandates that OBRA 1987 created, especially around issues of quality of life and the relative shift to home and community-based services. Tell us about these issues, about the paper.
Well, the article is from a leading research group using large public data, such as MDS assessments and Medicare files, to examine nursing home care. This particular study seeks to document changes since the Nursing Home Reform Act, or OBRA, which was passed in 1987, and even today remains the main congressional legislation driving nursing home regulation. So the study's goal was to look at how nursing homes have changed from before OBRA until today, or more accurately, until 2015, because that's when their analysis ended.
Yeah, so 30 years. So what were their main findings?
Well, there were two general topics they covered, the nursing homes themselves and the residents. Regarding the facilities, I was kind of surprised to learn that the actual number declined from 19,000 to around 16,000, mainly due to small homes closing, but otherwise they haven't changed much. The average nursing home now has a little over 100 beds, and that was typical back in the 80s. And despite the growing geriatric population in this country and the lack of nursing home growth, average occupancy has slipped from the high 80s to around 82%. This really means that nursing homes are not such a big part of the long-term care industry as they were, and reflects the fact that all of the growth in post-acute and long-term care services has been in assisted living and home-based care. The other big change they noted was a doubling in the proportion of short-stay post-acute patients who were reimbursed by Medicare.
for at least 25 years. Wow. So imagine how much more that would have been had the had they gone back and looked even back as far as the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it is interesting today how patients who are otherwise or individuals in the community who are otherwise nursing home certifiable are able to remain in the community due to better support systems. And of course, you know, we will see how social determinants of health, which is a very hot buzz term today, will play out ultimately. But you know, systems like PACE programs are growing in this country. What about the resident characteristics? How have they changed between the 80s and today with this study?
Well, one thing they've noted is an increase in minorities. In 1985, 92% of nursing home residents were white, whereas by 2015, it had decreased to 79%. This is in part due to the fact that whites who paid privately now predominate in assisted living. An even more striking change was the increase in residents reported to need assistance in ADLs. One statistic, for example, was that the proportion chair-bound increased from 40% in 1985 to 64% in 2015. The study also demonstrated a huge increase in the proportion of residents on antidepressants from 19% in 1995 to 49% in 2015.
Wow. And all of us who are working in the skilled setting today can definitely believe that is true. But was there anything else that you found particularly surprising about these data?
One other thing in particular. The paper reported that between 2000 and 2015, the proportion of nursing home residents admitted directly from a hospital increased from 66% to 85%. I'm trying to figure out why that is.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this, and it wasn't that long ago that patients who otherwise would be destined for long-term care would be dropped off in the emergency room and kept on as social holds until a facility could be found to admit them. And I have to wonder what role that played. But I also wonder about things like the prevalence of advanced care planning today, the evolution of hospital medicine, the rise of advanced practitioners and improved long-term care coverage by them, or the need to fill a bed in some areas, and whether, you know, any of these issues have played a role.
You know, it's funny you should mention this. The thing that got me researching long-term care in the first place was doing a study in 1979 of patients who were dropped off in the emergency department at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami. They became so numerous, and then one of them died and the newspapers got a hold of it, and finding placement was such a problem that the hospital set up a 30-bed ward just to house and place these seniors who didn't belong in the hospital. It had a full-time social worker, several nurse practitioners, and really became a geriatric unit.
You know, I was 15 in 1979, so I wish I could have read that study.
Well, don't rub it in, but it, you know, we could talk for a long time about the lessons from that study. It was so fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And not long after that came OBRA, which this article discusses. You know, interestingly, given you know how much your experience has been in this setting, what is your personal perspective on how nursing homes have changed since the 80s? Are this study's conclusions accurate?
You know, I wonder about that because, you know, to a certain extent, data can be manipulated. You know, it's a type of gamesmanship that the healthcare industry plays. You know, for example, we know that as soon as payment becomes tied to acuity, patients start looking sicker and more needy on paper, in part because the data recorded more diligently. So I got to thinking about my first years as a nursing home medical director in the early 1980s before OBRA, and there are a few things that stand out. For one thing, post-hospital rehab care was minimal. In 1980, the DRG system for hospitals had not yet been introduced, so patients stayed in hospitals a lot longer. I honestly didn't start interacting with rehab staff in a big way until later in the decade or maybe the 90s.
Wow.
So the growth of post-acute care has been huge. Another thing that I noticed right away back in the 80s was turnover. That has not changed. And the nursing staff overall had little formal training in gerontology and geriatrics. I'm not sure that's changed much either. But nowadays, there are clearly more systems, often developed and passed down from corporate. Another thing, and the one I'm least sure about, is whether residents are really sicker and whether they're really more ill, or whether we're just keeping people with end-stage chronic disease alive longer. We did have more ambulatory patients back then, all with pretty advanced dementia, and these have all largely moved to assisted living. So these are my big ticket impressions. Wayne, what do you think? You know, what, you know, in your experience, yep. You know, what's been happening?
Yeah, I have to agree. You know, I've seen the same things that you've seen. In fact, I remembered specifically in the mid-90s, I told an elderly woman, I think she was in her mid-90s, that it was time to be discharged. And she said to me, but I'm not through with my holiday yet. And actually, the attending physician said, just give her a few more days. But I got to tell you, I never interacted with rehab. Never did. And I also have to tell you that I believe that folks in long-term care are sicker, at least in the Massachusetts facilities, both corporate-owned and family-owned, that I've been medical director in. But, you know, Massachusetts has a formal training program for older adults with dementia, that if you call yourself a dementia unit, your staff needs to go through this program. But as you said, I have found that nursing staff is not necessarily well prepared in the care of older adults. You know, but as I said, folks are definitely more complicated. You know, at times, you know, we felt that we had to say to case managers, you know, the skilled setting is not a mini community hospital. And, you know, in addition, mm-hmm. and kind of as an aside, facilities used to cater to hospitals and to their case managers, educational dinners and fun events, which would guide patients their way. It's different today. You know, I know it was a business. I know it is a business, but you know, quality speaks volumes now to get patients that you want, and no amount of shrimp dinners, I think today is going to change that. Mm. You know, let's move on to our second paper in the February 2020 issue of JAMDA. I understand that it presents some guidelines for pain assessment in the nursing setting. Dr. Brown, tell us a little bit more about this one.
Yes, Wayne. This is an incredibly important topic, as up to 80% of nursing home residents are affected by pain. Pain can lead to poor functioning, we know, reduced quality of life, depression, anxiety, insomnia, and increased treatment costs. Unfortunately, because many residents assume pain is a part of aging, perhaps they don't want to be a burden, or we as providers don't ask the right questions, often the pain goes under-recognized and therefore untreated. Pain assessment is certainly further complicated in the setting of cognitive impairment. In order to treat pain most effectively, good pain assessment is imperative. A good assessment takes into account pain intensity, pain qualities, and the courses of pain to help in diagnosis and development of appropriate interdisciplinary interventions. A strong assessment can also help in evaluation of the effectiveness of the treatment intervention. The main guideline for pain assessment in older adults used previously, before this article, was not specific to nursing homes, and that was the reason that the investigators took a closer look at what might be utilized in nursing home level care in the assessment of pain.
You know, Dr. Brown, before we get into the meat of things, you know, I don't need to point out to our listeners that JAMDA is an international journal and continues to grow significantly in that regard. And this article specifically is from Germany. You know, in the United States, as part of the minimum data set, there are nurses who do assessments, you know, for things like pain early on in the admission process. And this paper is recommending that folks have pain assessments on admission. You know, so as an editor yourself, you know, how well do you think that the German considerations are aligned with, for, you know, actionable steps, et cetera, for our facilities here in the United States?
Well, I certainly believe that this is a great reminder for all of us, physicians anywhere, that we really should be stopping to assess our patients' pain scales, how patients are doing with regards to their pain, and how we're treating pain along the trajectory of their time that they're with us in nursing home level care. Mm. I'm not sure that this differs in the United States, based on my impression, as it does internationally. I think we all need to be doing a better job of assessing our residents' pain levels.
Great. So tell us a little more about this study.
Well, in an attempt to account for nursing home characteristics and their relationship to pain, including resident age, staff skill mix, and overall aims of the care, an interdisciplinary evidence-based clinical practice guideline for pain assessment in nursing homes was developed after looking at systemic literature search, including 39 studies and 12 international reference guidelines. The guideline that was created comprises recommendations around the context of pain assessment in nursing home care, screening, focused assessment, and then reassessment or monitoring of pain. The main recommendations put forth here stipulate that each resident should be screened for the presence of pain at the time of admission. Clinicians should assess the patient's ability to provide self-report of pain when screening for that pain, bearing in mind how cognitive impairment, delirium, and visual and hearing deficits may all play into their report. A focused assessment of pain performed during rest and activities should include pain intensity, changed behaviors, general mobility, pain history, and comorbidities. Pain should be reassessed at regular intervals using the same instruments that were used for the focused assessment and should really be done by all members of the team. Reduced pain, improved functioning, mood, and sleep are some of the suggested clinical endpoints that should be considered during monitoring. The work described in this article points out the need for systematic education and training of clinicians in assessing pain in our nursing home populations, particularly in those with whom it may be more difficult to converse. Even more so, staff who provide a large portion of the nursing home residents' personal care should be trained and supported as they may pick up changes or development of pain more quickly than physicians or nurses might.
You know, I'm reminded of a patient, a resident in long-term care in one of our dementia units. And as geriatricians, we're all trained, especially with folks who have cognitive impairment, that if there's an acute change and someone's otherwise stable, look for things like pain. And so we actually evaluated this gentleman and looked in his mouth. And he had an abscessed tooth that he wasn't yelling and screaming about, but it definitely was affecting him as a change. So, you know, a true focal assessment in our older adult population is key. And so I'm glad that this article is reminding us of the importance of doing that. Great. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post-Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post-Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
So our last topic for discussion involves long-term benzodiazepine use, an extremely relevant topic. We know that benzodiazepines are associated with delirium and falls, and yet the short-acting benzodiazepines, which are thought to be safer, but as geriatricians we know differently oftentimes, they're still prescribed in, significantly in the post-acute long-term care setting. So people have wondered whether they have long-term consequences, such as increasing the probability of dementia. So Dr. Sloan, I understand the February 2020 issue of JAMDA includes these three articles on this topic and an editorial as well. What are the take-home messages for our listeners?
Well, JAMDA was fortunate to receive three excellent longitudinal studies looking at the long-term impact of these drugs on older persons. Two of them addressed the question of whether benzodiazepine use increased the risk of developing dementia. The first enrolled 3,526 patients aged 70 to 78 in 116 family medicine practices in the Netherlands and followed them for an average of 6.7 years, a really massive study. Mm. About one-sixth of this sample were taking benzodiazepines long-term. Most of them were on short-acting forms. During that time, 233 persons developed dementia. The investigators found no association whatsoever between benzodiazepine use and dementia. Hmm. In fact, there was a non-significant protective trend, which probably has to do with who takes the drugs in ambulatory practice, rather than the drugs themselves. Interestingly, the study also looked at anticholinergic burden and dementia. And there they found significant associations, particularly with drugs such as urologic agents and tricyclic antidepressants, which have strongly anticholinergic effects. So we know that the study was powered well enough to find changes because they found them in these areas, but not with benzodiazepines.
Wow. You know, I recall distinctly as a young new geriatrician in the skilled setting talking to a physician who was very, very seasoned about his patient who was taking relatively large doses of benzodiazepine to sleep at night. And, if I recall, the patient was in her late 80s or early 90s and had a fall, had multiple falls. You know, a generation ago, these medications were thought to help depression and sleep. And, of course, we know very much differently now with regard to the older adult. But that physician who had taken care of a large number of patients told me, I won't forget it. He said, "I think that the side effect mumbo jumbo is overblown," and he would not reduce the dose of this medication. And I wonder how much that's occurring today. So what about the other study, the second study?
Well, can we comment on that for a minute? Because I think we both have thoughts about that.
Melody, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I continue to have a group of patients in their 90s who adamantly refuse to stop taking their benzodiazepines. And we have lengthy conversations about this, but they've taken them for many, many years to help with sleep, and nothing else seems to do the trick. So they, with full awareness of the risks, continue to utilize these medications against my better judgment.
And, of course, the addictive properties of them make them very, very difficult.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, but today, at least, we're informing folks. We're informing, and we're documenting, and we're monitoring. And I think those are the major take-homes for me, especially when I work with younger physicians and residents about the use of medications that we know will otherwise have potentially untoward effects.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, it will not apparently make dementia occur. And this gets into our second study, which is from Korea.
Yep.
And they've got a nationwide healthcare database, and they're beginning to do some really excellent research with that database. So they, in this study, there was a retrospective cohort design in which new users of benzodiazepines, age 50 and older, were followed up for 7 years and compared with non-users. The study found a 23% increase in dementia with a follow-up of 5 years, but the longer the follow-up was, the more it went down. And when they looked further into the data, they concluded this was what we call a spurious finding due to confounding by indication. And I'm explaining what that meant. Mm. In other words, what they concluded was that people with early cognitive impairment, no, too early to identify as dementia, were receiving more benzodiazepines. And this, of course, makes sense because anxiety is very common in people when they're starting to get memory loss. And so once they controlled for that, they found that the incidence of dementia, true dementia, did not seem to differ.
What about the third study?
Well, the third study asked a different question. whether giving benzodiazepines to people who already have dementia will accelerate their cognitive decline. And as you mentioned, you know, people who have dementia not infrequently get put on benzodiazepines long term.
Yep.
So this involves secondary analysis of data collected as part of a drug trial involving a calcium channel blocker. They were trying to prove that it, or see if it would reduce the progression of dementia. It was a negative study, so they figured since they'd gathered all this data, they might look at some other things. And one of the things they looked at was benzodiazepine use. They found that 62 of these individuals, that's 14%, were taking benzodiazepines during the trial. The outcomes looked at cognition, falls, and incident delirium. And they measured cognition with the Alzheimer's Disease Assessment Scale, or ADAS-COG, which is a very long instrument that's particularly sensitive to change, is therefore a favorite of drug trials, but is a great thing to use to look at this relationship. The study found no association between benzodiazepine use and the progression of cognitive decline. However, they did find a significant link between benzodiazepine use and delirium. The risk ratio was 2.44 and the p-value less than 0.001. They also confirmed that benzodiazepines increase the risk of falling. Here the risk ratio is 1.73 and the p-value 0.02. So the bottom line is that giving benzodiazepines to people with dementia won't worsen their cognition in the long run, but it will set them up to get delirium and to fall.
So, you know, I have to say, you know, it's amazing to me how often we hear the same things around the same issues over and over again in different forms. You would have thought we would learn by now. I mean, are you surprised with these links that they found?
Not really. In fact, a lot of research just seems to prove what clinicians already know.
Yeah.
But it's often good to see it confirmed, and the results sometimes bring nuances that are helpful even when the general message is not new.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown and Dr. Sloan, for the summary of these articles from the February 2020 issue of JAMDA. Under the leadership of co-editors-in-chief Dr. Philip Sloan and Cheryl Zimmerman, and associate editors like Dr. Mallory Brown, the Journal of the American Medical Director Association, JAMDA, with its highly regarded studies like those from the February 2020 issue, continue to be an impactful resource in post-acute and long-term care and beyond. Dr. Sloan and Dr. Brown, thank you so much for contributing to JAMDA On the Go.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com and www.jamda.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for JAMDA On the Go.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, go to our new learning management system at apex.paltc.org. Click on podcast and follow the link to this latest episode. Thank you.